Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. Here in the third hour, we start off our conversation dealing with some new reports on cancer-related deaths. Why does this matter? Well, there might be an explanation for why women's cancer-related deaths have gone up and men's have gone down, and it might have something to do with abortion. We'll be talking about that here in the first 25 minutes of the program, or this hour of the program. Karen Malik will be our guest. And then, in the last half hour, open lines, issues, etc., got a lot to play for you. First from the president addressing the national religious broadcasters in Dallas, Texas, and then from others who addressed the national religious broadcasters down there in Dallas. We will also hear from Jay Sekulow on whether he thinks the newly comprised Supreme Court, plus Samuel Alito, is going to deal with the issue of partial birth abortion when the issue comes back up again. And I believe we'll also hear from, now the name escapes me, but we'll get to her as well, on the same subject, optimistic or pessimistic, about how the Supreme Court might deal with partial birth abortion now that it is a full court with two new justices. Karen Malik is a regular guest on the program. She's president of the Coalition on Abortion Breast Cancer based in Palos Heights, Illinois. Karen, welcome back.
Thank you.
Is there an explanation, a plausible explanation, for why women's cancer deaths have gone up while men's have gone down?
Well, it's breast cancer, the breast cancer deaths that is keeping the total number of cancer deaths for all cancers up. For 2006, the breast cancer cases, or rather the total number of women's cancer deaths, actually went up by about 400 cases, whereas men's cancer deaths went down by just under 800 cancer cases, or rather cancer deaths. So we're seeing the women's deaths going up in contrast to the men's deaths. And the reason why there was a net decline of cancer deaths is because fewer people are using tobacco, and so you have fewer cancer deaths due to lung cancer and other types of cancers that tobacco contributes to. But it's breast cancer that is really keeping those cancer deaths higher than they need to be. And because the cancer establishment is not being honest about the abortion breast cancer link with the American people, because they're keeping people in the dark about this risk, we have more cancer deaths than we need to have. And decline in cancer deaths would have taken place, the net decline in cancer deaths would have taken place sooner, years ago, if women had been told the truth about abortion. But unfortunately, these cancer fundraising organizations, which are out there every year begging for money, and they've got women who are marching in the streets raising money for them, they're just keeping women in the dark about this.
Why has the American Cancer Society, to kind of talk about the largest cancer fundraising organization there is, why have they continued to deny the link, and I'd like you to explain that link, between abortion and breast cancer?
Well, I think that's a very good question, but there are a number of plausible answers for that. We do have research going back to 1957 that the cancer establishment kept women in the dark about. We didn't know about the existence of this research showing that abortion raises risk, and they studied this intensively. We have a mountain of research, diverse research, biological evidence, epidemiological evidence. We have animal research. We have a plausible biological explanation. We know the reason for it, but they have kept women totally in the dark about it. But some of the reasons why the American Cancer Society may have done so may be because, number one, it's simply not good for fundraising to tell women that their earlier abortions may have contributed or caused their breast cancers. It's, you know, there are women who have breast cancer out there now who may not have had abortions. Some of these women are unhappy that word is getting out about this. Some of these women call themselves Christians, which is very, very unfortunate because I'm a cancer survivor myself, a survivor of colon cancer, and I happen to believe that breast cancer survivors or other cancer survivors should want to spare other people my own suffering, suffering from cancer. There are also women who've had breast cancer who have had abortions and they don't want their neighbors suspecting them of having had abortions. So this is a very politically explosive issue. It's one that politicians want to duck. They want to hide from, especially if they have been promoting abortion, if they have been, if they've had their hands in the pockets of the abortion industry, just as the tobacco state congressmen had their hands in the pockets of the tobacco industry. Another possible reason, well, they do spend a great deal of money on fundraising at the American Cancer Society. They spend millions, rather not fundraising, on lobbying. They spend millions on lobbying every year. So these are some possible reasons. Also because of feminist ideology, there are a great many feminists who are very, very active in this breast cancer fundraising, these breast cancer fundraising groups. Some of these feminists in other organizations who lead the cancer fundraising groups have previously worked in the abortion industry. And, for instance, if you look at a San Francisco group called Breast Cancer Action, their leader, their executive director, formerly was on a board of directors for the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, and this is a breast cancer, or rather this is a an abortion advocacy group that has been very aggressive in the courts trying to keep abortion legal and accessible for American women. Also, some of their board members formerly worked for Planned Parenthood in some capacity, in one capacity or another. If you look at the National Breast Cancer Coalition, they have a board member who formerly was involved with an abortion clinic. And if you look at the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation, they have given money to Planned Parenthood over the years. And although they claim that this is for screening women for breast cancer, I find this very, very offensive because there are perfectly legitimate organizations, hospitals, for instance, that could be receiving these funds and which perform the same services. Also, it's very, very easy to move money around in an organization from one function to or service to another. So it would be very easy for them to move their funding from the breast cancer side of the business, breast cancer screening side of the business, to the abortion side of the business at Planned Parenthood. And they have been caught doing that. In Colorado, they were caught moving their funds from one side of the business, the education side, over to the abortion side. Colorado state auditors caught them doing that just a few short years ago.
Karen, can you explain what you referred to earlier as the plausible link between abortion and breast cancer?
Yes. This is a very, very simple explanation that's easy for people to understand. When girls, at birth, girls are born with cancer-vulnerable breast tissue called type 1 lobules. The breasts are the only organs in a baby girl that are undeveloped. At puberty, the breasts grow, and at that time, some of the breast lobules mature a little bit into cancer-vulnerable type 2 lobules. So the young woman who has never had a baby before, a full-term pregnancy, has type 1 and type 2 lobules in her breasts. About 70% of her lobules are type 1. This is where cancers are known to arise. So the young woman who has never had a full-term pregnancy is in a cancer-vulnerable state. And the longer she is in that cancer-vulnerable state, the longer she goes without having that first full-term pregnancy, the greater her breast cancer risk is. The reason for that is that with every monthly menstrual cycle, she's overexposed to estrogen. Estrogen is a female hormone. It causes breast growth at puberty. It causes breast growth during a normal pregnancy. And when she has her period, she's overexposed to this hormone. It's also known as a carcinogen. It's recognized as a carcinogen. So this carcinogen now is stimulating her cancer-vulnerable breast tissue month after month after month when she has her menstrual periods. When she does get pregnant, if it's a normal pregnancy, not one that is destined to end in a first trimester miscarriage, but if she's carrying a normal pregnancy, then she notices that her breasts are growing starting early in pregnancy. That's the estrogen that is making her breasts grow. And the estrogen stimulates these cancer-vulnerable lobules, type 1 and 2 lobules, to start multiplying. So she gets more cancer-vulnerable lobules. This process goes on during the first and second trimesters of pregnancy with the breast growth, the estrogen increasing in her bloodstream and stimulating these cancer-vulnerable lobules. Now, in the third trimester of pregnancy, starting at 32 weeks of pregnancy, there's another process that kicks in called differentiation. And this is a critical process, a very important process to the woman, because at 32 weeks of pregnancy, this process shuts off the cell multiplication process. So the breast growth stops. The cell multiplication stops. And now her breast tissue, her breast lobules, are matured into milk-producing, cancer-resistant tissue. So that the woman who has a full-term pregnancy, the woman that goes to 42 or 40 weeks of pregnancy, she's left with more cancer-resistant tissue than she had before she became pregnant. This is why women who have children starting at a younger age and women who have a larger family, more children, have a lower lifetime risk for the disease. There's no debate among scientists that the single most important thing a woman can do to prevent breast cancer is to have that early first full-term pregnancy. And there's also no debate among scientists that the woman who has a larger family has a lower lifetime risk for the disease. Even the American Cancer Society agrees with those two statements. And so that is the biology that supports those findings.
Now,
but the woman that has the abortion, she's gone through that cancer multiplication, or rather that cell multiplication process during the first two trimesters where she got more type 1 and 2 lobules, but she misses out on the third trimester process that protects her from that estrogen overexposure earlier in the pregnancy, and that would have matured her breast tissue into cancer-resistant tissue. The woman who has the abortion is left with more cancer-vulnerable type 1 and 2 lobules than she had before she became pregnant. And as I said earlier, the type 1 lobules are the lobules that scientists say most cancers originate in.
Now, two quick questions before we let you go, Karen. Let's deal with the question that always comes up when we talk with you, and that is about spontaneous miscarriage. And a woman who's had a miscarriage says, hey, my pregnancy lasted only into the first trimester. Am I then left with those more vulnerable cells and therefore at a higher risk of breast cancer, or is that different from abortion?
It's different biologically speaking because most of the first trimester miscarriages do not involve estrogen overexposure. That is well established in the science, and yet the American Cancer Society and the U.S. National Cancer Institute, which is the government agency responsible for being a quote-unquote cancer watchdog, they both mislead women about this and suggest they mix up the effects of miscarriage with the effects of abortion and say neither raise risk. But the fact of the matter is that miscarriage does not raise risk. Most of the miscarriages, first trimester miscarriages, do not raise risk. And the woman can sort of tell if she's had a first trimester miscarriage. A lot of women will notice, gee, I didn't feel pregnant. My breasts didn't grow. They weren't tingling during pregnancy, and I didn't feel nauseous. Well, that's a sign that her hormone level wasn't high enough to maintain that pregnancy.
A listener is curious, apparently, and I don't know about this, but there is a drug for women who have brought a child to full term that can cut off or diminish the flow of milk.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an additional risk here? Does that have any effect upon this for a woman who's carried a child to full term but isn't breastfeeding?
Well, I think that there may be, I think I would refer the question to our experts for an answer to that. However, I would say this. The woman who does not breastfeed is losing an important opportunity to reduce her risk for breast cancer, because there was a study that was done in 2002, and this was actually a major review paper done by Oxford scientists, and they reviewed 47 studies conducted in 30 countries. It involved many thousands of women, and what they found after reviewing these studies that we could reduce the breast cancer rates in developed nations like ours by more than 50% if women would breastfeed their children longer and if women would have larger families, if they would have more children. And they said that in some of the undeveloped nations, the breast cancer rates have been very, very low historically, but they're just starting to creep up because the women are starting to have smaller families and do less breastfeeding like we do in the developed nations. The breastfeeding, they estimated, would account for most of the reduction in breast cancer rates if women would undertake these new childbearing patterns. Traditionally, our childbearing patterns involved larger families, longer periods of breastfeeding. We changed those patterns within the last half a century. Even the American Cancer Society admits on its website that much of the increased number of breast cancer cases that have taken place over the last few decades is due to changes in, quote, reproductive patterns, changes in our childbearing patterns, such as delaying the birth of a first child. We're having our first babies at a later age and also having a smaller family. Now, they admit that much on their website at the American Cancer Society, but yet everybody knows that abortion and use of contraceptives have contributed to that, that abortion and use of contraceptives, in fact, are responsible for those changes in our childbearing patterns. but yet they refuse to implicate abortion in any way, shape, or form. And I would like to mention also that there was a significant development last year. We had a couple of significant developments, actually. But there was a significant development involving the United Nations World Health Organization. And that organization put out a press release at the end of July last year acknowledging that women who use combined oral contraceptives, which could include estrogen plus the progestins in them, women who use these oral contraceptives or who use the combined hormone replacement therapy, which is what women take after menopause, they're exposing themselves to carcinogens, and the World Health Organization labeled these drugs, quote, group one carcinogens, which means they had the highest, the strongest evidence for showing that these are probable carcinogens, probable risk factors for breast cancer. So I think these were important developments, and I think also it's important to mention that women have been told over the years, use oral contraceptives in order to reduce your risk of ovarian cancer or endometrial cancer. I have a real problem with that because, according to the World Health Organization, use of oral contraceptives will raise risk of breast cancer, liver cancer, and cervical cancer. Those three cancers cause about two times as many cancers than ovarian cancer and the endometrial cancer.
Karen Malik is president of the Coalition on Abortion Breast Cancer based in Palos Heights, Illinois. You can find out more about them on the web, abortionbreastcancer.org. It's all one word, abortionbreastcancer.org. That's their website. Karen, thank you for your time. Thanks for being our guest.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
When we come back from this break, we're going to be spending some time listening to a bit of audio from the National Religious Broadcasters Convention in Dallas, Texas. Now, a couple days ago, we heard a few comments made by Pagels and Kay Arthur, I believe. We'll hear Kay Arthur again. But first, we're going to hear President George W. Bush. He sent a videotaped address to those who were gathered in Dallas for the National Religious Broadcasters. And we're also going to hear from Henry Blackaby. He's the author of Experiencing God. Kay Arthur, I mentioned her. She's going to talk a bit more about Israel and her concern for evangelicals, Christians' support of Israel. And we've got other audio to play for you. It's open lines. Anything you want to talk about, our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're back with you live this Wednesday here in the studio. It's February the 22nd. The call-in numbers again, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be right back with open lines after this.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Many Christians today are reading the prophet Ezekiel in a rather odd way. They view this book as a roadmap for the end times, a chronology of what will happen when the nation of Israel is restored and the temple is rebuilt in Jerusalem. Is this what the prophet Ezekiel was really talking about? How can we find Christ in the book of Ezekiel? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for February is a commentary on Ezekiel, the first 20 chapters. It's authored by noted Old Testament scholar Dr. Horace Hummel. Order the Concordia commentary on Ezekiel by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. You can also browse before you buy. Just visit our website, issuesetc.org, and there on the homepage, you'll find the Issues Etc. book of the month for February, the Concordia commentary on Ezekiel, chapters 1 through 20. The book is $42.99 plus shipping and handling.
Day. When does it mean day?
Answers with Ken Ham, co-author of the popular Answers book. Okay, Ken, I have a feeling you're going to use one of those tongue twisters of yours to explain the word day, right?
Well, when I was speaking at a seminar on the days of creation in Genesis chapter 1, a pastor came up to me and said, "But the word day can mean something other than an ordinary day." "That's true," I said, "but it can also mean an ordinary day." He replied, "But the word day can mean something other than an ordinary day." I stated again, "But it can also mean an ordinary day." You know, to stop this conversation, I then said to him, "Look, tell me, can the word day mean day? And if it can mean a day, when does it mean a day?" He looked at me perplexed. I explained to him that any word can have more than one meaning depending on the context. The word day has a number of different meanings, but its main meaning is a typical day. It means an ordinary day when it's used with the words evening and morning and with a number as it is in Genesis 1. In other words, the meaning of the word day in Genesis 1 is determined by the context.
Ken Ham has written some fascinating information on the 6 days of creation. To read his free booklet on the Creation Week, just go to our popular and easy-to-use website, AnswersRadio.com. You'll also find additional intriguing topics like dinosaurs, the origin of races, our future creation museum, and so on. Go to AnswersRadio.com.
God calls men of all ages to serve as his pastors.
Professor Rick Neufer, coordinator of the Alternate Routes to Ordination at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
I am privileged to work with many older men who desire to serve the Lord in the ordained ministry. The Alternate Routes program provides a way in which experienced laymen, teachers, principals, DCEs, and other commissioned ministers can receive seminary training in a shorter period of time than in the Master of Divinity program. Although no degree is awarded in the Alternate Routes program, Alternate Routes students still serve a vicarage as part of their program and receive all the theological education they will need for ordination. The churches of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod are filled with people of all ages. Thus, the church needs pastors of all ages. Have you ever thought about the pastoral ministry but have said, "I am too old"? Think again.
Concordia Theological Seminary, www.ctsfw.edu.
How do you describe Worldwide KFUO's new high-definition broadcast to folks accustomed to listening on traditional analog AM radios? Imagine that AM 850 KFUO now sounds like an FM station when heard over the latest digital radios. You're in stereo with no static. Be assured that our HD broadcast will still work on your old radio, but when you make the switch, the music will sound like a CD. On AM 850, KFUO.
It's my pleasure to address my friends at the National Religious Broadcasters Annual Convention. I applaud your role in bringing the good news to millions of our fellow citizens.
That was President George W. Bush speaking via a taped message to the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, which concluded yesterday in Dallas, Texas. We were at one several years ago in Nashville, and it was an interesting experience, I must say. Huge, huge convention center, and I have to admit, felt a little awkward at this beautiful Nashville hotel. But the convention center is full of all sorts of programs, all sorts of television programs, radio programs. That's why we were there. In addition to people who are trying to sell books and you name it. It was pretty much kind of Christian media central. What did we find? Very little cross. It's supposed to be a Christian broadcasters convention. Very little cross. An awful lot of merchandising. And the message of the various, the various outlets, shows there, while they're all promoting themselves, nothing wrong with that, their messages seem to be more along the lines of Christian culture than along the lines of the Christian message of salvation in Jesus Christ. Now, I know that somewhere beneath all of that, the lights, the fancy show, the various promotions, there's supposed to be in the National Religious Broadcasters a goal of bringing that message of Jesus Christ. It is a Christian organization, by the way. That message of Jesus Christ to the world and especially to America. The president says, "I applaud you for your efforts to bring the good news." My experience with NRB, if there was good news there, it was playing second fiddle to a lot of other news. Well, here's President George W. Bush again at the national, speaking to the National Religious Broadcasters via taped broadcast. He says that religious broadcasters have an important role.
Our nation's religious broadcasters help to remind all Americans that there is a power and purpose beyond our own lives. You carry a message of hope that there is a source of love and compassion that can transform our hearts and bring peace to the world.
Whatever that may be, I don't know. Well, I want your thoughts on this. The president talking to national religious broadcasters, there's no doubt about it. When the largest cable satellite network on the globe is TBN, that this is a force to be reckoned with. Our call-in numbers, it's open lines, issues, et cetera. We've got a lot of audio for you. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You do have to rate to get the president to address you, even by tape. You do. It happens only to the largest of denominations. The president did address via videotape the Southern Baptist Convention, but most don't rate. The national religious broadcasters do. Well, here he is again, the president. He says he appreciates the religious broadcasters' backing of his various concerns, including his anti-abortion efforts.
I thank you for your support of the ban on partial birth abortion. I was proud to sign that bill into law, and we will continue to vigorously defend the law in the courts.
Okay, here's the president turning to the national religious broadcasters. Well, where their two interests coincide. I said that when we went to NRB, it was more Christian culture issues than it was cross. And I think that was a fair assessment. So while the president applauds the national religious broadcasters for their effort to bring the good news, give people purpose and hope in their lives, kind of ill-defined, where the concerns of the two meet are on these issues. Now, don't get me wrong. I got no problem with the president's efforts to end or to curtail to regulate abortion. I'm very glad, especially on partial birth abortion, to have anyone helping that they can, and I'm glad the president is doing his part as well. But one learns kind of what this is really about when the president gets to the meat of his concerns. This is about the culture and what's come to be known as the culture wars. An important thing? Of course it is. Very important. As important as the main purpose and hope Christian religious broadcasters have, at least have in theory, to bring to the world? No. As important as it is, not as important as the message of Christ crucified for sinners. The president also told the national religious broadcasters that the Constitution should be amended to prevent judges from requiring the legalization of same-sex marriage.
Because marriage is a sacred institution and the foundation of society, it should not be redefined by activist judges. For the good of families and society, I support a constitutional amendment to protect the institution of marriage.
I think on this score, on those two scores, on partial birth abortion and a constitutional amendment to ban partial birth abortion, the president has a very friendly audience here in National Religious Broadcasters. I'm glad that they're making those efforts. Now, here's where a little caution might be in order, however. These are good, thus saith the Lord, kind of issues where religious broadcasters ought to be speaking. There are other thus saith the Lord issues that also need to be addressed as well. I mentioned one, the biggest one of all, that is what should be the central message of Christian broadcasting, be it television, internet, radio, the message of the Christ crucified for sinners. Now, we cannot blame the president for saying, I want you to get out there and I want you to join me in my efforts to see to it that the gospel is preached everywhere. That's not his job. It's their job. At least they will say it's their job, or they'll present it as their job. But the caution here is that the national religious broadcasters simply say, look, what we're really here is just about a conservative cultural agenda. While that may be a great thing to work for, then you should have a different organization, calling yourself the National Conservative Cultural Agenda Broadcasters. One of the keynote speakers at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention in Dallas was Henry Blackaby. He's a Bible teacher and author of books like Experiencing God. Now, notice what he's going to talk about here. He says people at the Pentagon report ominous intelligence to him.
The increased chatter of the terrorists indicates that they are planning a serious attack on America.
I'm not joking. I'm not making this up. When I listened to this cut with Jeff before the broadcast, I said, is that the one you want? I thought it was supposed to be National Religious Broadcasters. That sounded like someone addressing a group of defense officials at the Pentagon. Okay. Here's Henry Blackaby again. He says the next National Day of Prayer may be crucial.
I have a tremendous sense that this year's National Day of Prayer may well determine much of the future of our nation.
Okay, the subject of the war on terrorism must have been a big subject at NRB. And I don't know what he means by crucial. Maybe he means that it will be crucial for turning the tide in the war on terrorism if Christians actually get together and pray about this. I have to ask, where's the Thus Saith the Lord on this subject? Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's Open Lines, Issues, etc. Playing some audio from the National Religious Broadcasters Convention in Dallas. Henry Blackaby, we just heard him, President George W. Bush, before that. We heard from Kay Arthur, Bible teacher and author, on Monday during Open Lines in the last part of the program. Let's hear some more from her on the United States and divine judgment.
A righteous and holy God cannot overlook sin in a nation that has a foundation like we have and has God's name engraved in marble in our nation's capital.
Okay, now hold that in your mind. Let's compare and contrast that with what Kay Arthur had to say. You heard this on Monday. This is what she had to say about Israel.
If I was ever forced to choose between the United States of America or Israel, I would have to choose Israel.
Now, this confuses me a little bit, because while the United States is not without its corporate and national sins, the permission of abortion for the last 33 years being one of them, and is not without culpability in God's eyes, certainly not. And she's right when she says God does not tolerate sin in individuals or even in groups of individuals, in nations. When she's right to say that, I wonder, what about Israel's sin? I mean, there's no doubt about it that Israel has, well, if it's another nation, it's sinful like any other nation, right? And if she would prefer Israel over America if she had to choose between the two, does she feel like, America with its sin should expect God's divine judgment? Israel can do as it pleases? We've talked with people who have expressed strong concerns about the Israeli government's treatment of Palestinians and Christian Palestinians in particular. What about the sin of, I don't know, unbelief? America is a less believing nation than it used to be, but Israel is largely atheistic. And even if they were thoroughgoing, devout Jews, Old Testament, not Old Testament, but practicing Judaism, there still is that pesky question of not believing in Jesus, which means that if let's say the entire state of Israel, for which K. Arthur has so much affection and loyalty, really, if push comes to shove, more loyalty than for her home country, if the entire nation of Israel were, in fact, practicing Judaism, would God be tolerant of its unbelief? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Judaism and its rejection of Jesus Christ is no closer to Christianity than atheism or Islam. While I wait for your calls, LCMS World Relief is extending its Christ-centered, cross-focused care even as we speak. You've heard the latest of these natural disasters, mudslides in the Philippines. Mudslides that overtook entire villages, and they're still looking for people, and the relief efforts and the rescue efforts are being thwarted by continued danger of mudslides and bad weather. Into those very kinds of places, LCMS World Relief is bringing the message of the cross and the care and concern of Christians like you. You can donate 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438. Or find LCMS World Relief, concern for both body and soul, at our website, issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org. It's Open Lines, Issues, etc. We're talking about some of the audio from the National Religious Broadcasters. The president applauding these broadcasters for helping him in his efforts against abortion, partial birth abortion, and also to see to it that there's a constitutional amendment, if necessary, to ban gay marriage. And then Kay Arthur saying, look, our nation's got to repent of its sins. And as far as I can tell, given a pass to Israel, there were others who spoke there. Oh, Henry Blackaby also addressing the issue of, I guess, homeland security or the goings-on at the Pentagon as the keynote speaker at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention. It's an odd mix of things you get when you go to one of these things. What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You would think if you went to the National Islamic Broadcasters, I don't know where that would be, but if you went there, you'd expect to see, you would expect the message to be, you know, let's be more obedient to Allah. See to it that we get, everyone obeys Sharia law, encouraging women to wear the burqa, things like that you get in Islamist nations. If you went to a national Buddhist, you might, you know, encouraging people to meditate more or something along those lines. Christian broadcasters get together and they talk about homeland security. Their keynote speaker, who's invited there because he's written books about experiencing God, talks about his inside knowledge of what's going on in the Pentagon and the chatter that he hears from terrorists. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It just seems a little odd to me. Does it to you? Let's talk with Andy in Kirkwood. Andy, well, welcome.
Todd, this may be a symptom of something that you've discussed on Issues, etc., which is the idea that America is becoming a polytheistic nation, whereas the idea of who God is precisely is not to be pinned down. There was an article in a recent local newspaper about a very educated and devout man who's a pastor in a Christian denomination, and he said that he had been reconsidering the Kyrie Eleison, and he had decided that for himself that he would recite it in this way, Lord have mercy, Yahweh have mercy, Allah have mercy. And, of course, he may be very educated, but he doesn't realize that he's just insulted all three of the religions that he's trying to be tolerant of. Obviously, he's insulted the Muslims by naming a god other than Allah. He's insulted the Jews in two ways, by naming a god other than Yahweh and by naming Yahweh himself, simply because that name is not to be pronounced. And he's insulted the Christians because he's named not only another god in Allah, but also failed to name the name of Christ, which is in the original Kyrie. There's an awful lot of ignorance going on out there that's just being passed off as Christianity these days.
Andy, thank you very much. Well, yeah, that general concern expressed there in your last comment is certainly true. I wonder how many Christians would be insulted by such a Kyrie. They might say, well, fair is fair. I mean, come on. Lord, Yahweh, Allah, isn't it all the same thing? That distinction, that basic distinction, as you point out, is difficult to make, not only for the well-educated, Andy, but for a lot of Christians. Why? Well, maybe it has to do with the loss of focus, not only at NRB in Dallas, but in our pulpits on Sunday morning. When God is spoken of in our hymns and our prayers and our preaching in an almost entirely generic way, do we blame people when they come up with ideas like this? I mean, we should, but do we realize why it happens? Oddly enough, I think that lack of focus is just the symptom that we're seeing at something like National Religious Broadcasters. We went down there and we saw everything and anything and very little cross. There were booths about the end times. There were booths about diets, Holy Land diets, lots of diet booths down there. It was amazing how many diets there were. There were people pushing books. There were lots of music booths, people telling you here's their music. You could find anything there. It was a general religious expo, I would say. And you could have walked through from one, and I think I said this at the time when we came back from Nashville, could have walked through from one end to the other without looking too closely and might have thought, you know, this is just any broadcaster's convention. Yes, a loss of focus. That's why we talk about Christ-centered, cross-focused. That's what makes Christianity Christian. A church with non-Trinitarian praise music. It's a loss of focus. You've got praise music to God, and everyone there may be a Christian. Okay, let's just assume everyone in the church is a Christian. And they're all saying, we praise God, we love God, we adore God, we think God is great. Do that long enough without saying who God is, maybe even less than a generation, ask those people who that God is, and they won't be able to tell you Father, Son, and Holy Spirit because they've never heard it or sung it. No recitation along with the generic God songs of the classical creeds of the Christian faith. Now, those are too detailed, you know. And you avoid that long enough, and you will have people who will not be able to articulate their faith in anything resembling classical Christianity. I'm not talking about putting it in Latin and German. I'm talking about just saying, I believe in God the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. What did the Father do? I don't know, but I think he's great. What did the Son do? I haven't a clue, but I love him with all my heart. And what did the Spirit do? Oh, the Spirit. Spirit makes me feel good inside. T.D. Jakes called the next Billy Graham, and there could not be a bigger gulf, fundamental gulf, between Billy Graham, who for all his faults still affirms the Trinity, and T.D. Jakes, who denies it. But it doesn't surprise me that T.D. Jakes would be hailed as the next Billy Graham. Even sans Trinity. Well, the Supreme Court is going to consider a legal challenge to the federal ban on partial birth abortion. Let's hear from both sides of this issue. Here's first Kim Gandy of the National Organization for Women. She says that the ban is more broad than the supporters are willing to admit.
I'm not optimistic that Judge Alito or Judge Roberts, Justice now, Alito and Roberts, will recognize that precedent.
They're concerned that the precedent being Roe v. Wade is going to go unrecognized by the new court. And it is a new court, especially when it comes to partial birth abortion. It's not a new court when it comes to Roe, but it does portend perhaps some changes on those laws that have been knocked down by previous courts banning partial birth abortion. Here's Gandy again. She says that the law is written so broadly that it bans actually two procedures, not one.
Congress then essentially reenacted the very same provision, perhaps hoping that the Supreme Court would change its composition by the time the case got back up to them.
Well, it did change its composition. And for the life of me, I couldn't understand why even the previous court wouldn't ban partial birth abortion, but they did. Here's Kim Gandy again. She says that Sandra Day O'Connor voted with the majority when the court struck down a state law banning the procedure in 2000.
Without her on the court, it leaves a split court, and now Sam Alito will be the deciding vote on that case.
Okay, so Alito is going to be the one that makes the decision here. Well, he just replaced Sandra Day O'Connor. We don't know this, by the way. We don't know this for sure. Kim Gandy thinks it's pretty sure, and we'll hear in a moment from Jay Sekulow, if our time permits, who thinks it's pretty sure as well. But we don't know. Judge Alito expressed himself fairly well during his confirmation hearings. But do you remember Sandra Day O'Connor saying during her confirmation hearings, I am opposed to abortion, and then consistently upheld Roe all her years on the court? What they say and what they do is often two different things. Gandy says that the federal law coming before the Supreme Court this fall is almost the same as the state law that the High Court struck down in 2000.
The description in the legislation covers not just the DNX procedure, but the one that's called D&E, which is used far more often and is used in the second trimester of pregnancy, starting at 13 weeks.
It's the first time I've ever heard her admit this. Now, she's calling it D&E and not partial birth abortion because dilation and extraction is just a technical term for what happens in a partial birth abortion. And she's admitted it happens late and it happens far more often. I thought we were told when these laws were being formulated in the states that this never happens. These laws are unnecessary because this hardly ever happens. It's such a rare procedure. If it is, it shouldn't concern anyone, really, that it's on the verge, perhaps, through the Supreme Court, of being banned in the states that have passed laws banning it. Kim Gandy of the National Organization for Women says that this case will test the new justices' promise to uphold the Supreme Court's previous decisions. Remember Stare Decisis? Both of them made big wind about Stare Decisis.
That's one of the reasons the Supreme Court struck it down the first time around. It will impact a larger number of people.
Well, I'm just glad to hear her admit this, that partial birth abortion is more common than they used to tell us it was. They used to tell us it's rare. And now she's saying it will affect a large... Which is it, Kim? Is it a rare procedure that needs not even the one jot or tittle of law written to regulate it? Or is it, well, at least not so rare as not to affect large numbers of people? When she doesn't want to see these bans, when she wants to see these bans overturned, now it's going to affect more people than when she didn't want the law written in the first place. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, is holding several retreats all across the country throughout the spring months. I want to tell you about two of them. There's one on the Lord's Prayer. There's also one on Christ in the Old Testament that's going to be held by the Reverend Dr. John Seleska, a regular guest here on this program. If you've ever heard him on the program, I just met one of his relatives when we were out in California this weekend. If you ever heard him on the program, you know what you're in for to sit at his feet as he teaches about Christ in the Old Testament. That's the May 2006 biblical retreat that's being held at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, call them at area code 260-452-2247, 260-452-2247. It's going to be held early in May, and you need to register 2 weeks before that retreat. 260-452-2247. Find out more about Concordia Theological Seminary at our website, issuesetc.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.